Good night. It's the art of sharing on High Alert. We look at the impact of file sharing on artists and culture. We begin with Jason Black of the band Senses Fail and Hot Water Music. We carry on the conversation with Montreal author and concertina virtuoso Kathleen Winter. And to bring it all home, we speak with infamous digital rights advocate and rapper, Mr. Dan Bull. Hold on to your ears, you're on High Alert!
Like the record industry, they just treated people like idiots, so at some point people find a way to go around it, you know.
I don't think things are as, you know, precious to people, you know, like they're disposable almost, you know. Almost seems like music might be kind of disposable and not that big a deal.
I think that music is supposed to be shared, and if it's shared freely, that's fine with me. I don't hide in the shed and write songs for no one to hear them.
So that was Hugo Medea of the St. Catharines, John Snodgrass of Drag the River, and Tim Berry of Tim Berry.
That's right, and my name is Tebow.
This is Alex P. Megalis.
I am George Spinbinder.
And you're listening to episode 3 of High Alert on file sharing and illegal file sharing.
File sharing and its impact on artists, art, and culture.
And our guests today are Jason Black of Hot Water Music and Sense Failed.
Kathleen Winter, who's a Montreal-based author.
And Dan Bull, rapper extraordinaire from the United Kingdom. Yeah.
So before we start with the interviews, I think it'd probably be interesting to kind of bring up how we've tackled this episode and where each of us comes from.
And I've got to say, I really struggle with this episode. This is the one that I didn't really get from the get-go. When we were talking about file sharing, it didn't really automatically make sense as a topic for the High Alert podcast. When we set out to do this podcast, there was this strong sense of wanting to make sense of our position at the crossroads in time right now. We're living in these exceptional times, and I saw this podcast as something that would allow me to understand where we're at in history, and I didn't really see how file sharing was going to contribute to it, but now I do, and it's become clear. And I think what was important for me to get to that consideration was a reflection on the social purpose of art in general. Art, in a lot of ways, can be such a powerful representation of the social context. There's the idea that art is political. And the more I think about that, the more I want to think about, well, how is an artist like Justin Bieber political? How is Muzak political? How is a Harry Potter novel political? And all of those things are representations of the politics of the time. If there's an aggressive depoliticization at play in all of these forms of art, well, there's a reason for it.
It's certainly interesting when we see the hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars, that are thrown at various politicians around the world by people like the MPAA or the RIAA, the folks that are pushing for stronger regulation from within the entertainment industry, to see how much of that money is really being spent to push treaties that are sort of international in scope, to push laws like SOPA and PIPA that are more national in scope. Over the last 5 years, it seems like every 6 months we see a new law of some sort or a new treaty of some sort that sort of gets driven forward by these organizations.
And to me, coming into the show and coming from a more punk rock background, this show to me was about community and supporting your community. And throughout making of this show, I kept thinking of the lyric from Fugazi's song where it's not what you're selling, it's what you're buying. And we are at a point in time where buying your favorite band's record or going to see a movie, getting a book is optional because in a few clicks you can get that for free. So it's not a question of sharing as much as the question of supporting. In an age of consumerism, it is interesting to reflect on how we consume music, art. And so we can look at it from two different perspectives. The perspective of the artist who's trying to make a living off their art, but also from the perspective of the listener. How is it that you want to listen and consume and appreciate art?
I think that from the perspective of the artist, there's a fair amount of variance. You've got people like some of you've got people that have been birthed out of the punk DIY movement that have come up over the last few decades and managed to eke out a living by doing shows, by selling albums, by selling merchandise. And some of those folks are now caught in a situation where the whole model of how you make money as a musician is sort of inevitably changing. And as a part of that, they're losing part of the income that they perhaps were getting previously through album sales and are forced to adapt to finding new ways to gain income. And some people are doing that quite successfully in terms of finding more revenue through shows, more revenue through merchandise, more revenue through alternative means that maybe weren't considered previously. But not everybody is that success story, and there are people that suffer. It's not just necessarily the major labels that are sort of losing that revenue, even though we see things like $63 billion in lost revenue in the 2011 stats that are sort of trotted out by the recording industry and the movie industry. And and those stats are sort of consistently proven to be inaccurate. We, you know, even if it's not $63 billion, it's disappearing year after year. It's a certain amount of money out of people's pocket. It's interesting to me that you've got this whole new era of musicians who are able to adapt and survive within the new model. You've got some of the old timers that are able to adapt as well, but you've got a number of people that 20, 30 years ago were really about sort of bucking the system and doing something for themselves and stepping away from the sort of mainstream mechanics that were used to generate money in the music industry are now sort of rallying against a new model that changes that even further.
And so the thing that I want to keep in mind as we get into listening to some of these interviews is where is the resistance coming from?
One of the things that I like about this first interview, Jason Black, bass player for Hot Water Music, who's going to be coming to Montreal playing at the Molson Center. And I think this is fitting to say that within the punk rock world, who would have thought that three punk bands would play the Molson Center in September, and Hot Water Music will be playing with the Gaslight Anthem and Rise Against. But what I like about this interview, coming from Jason Black, who comes from the punk rock community, is that he's not meek in talking about file sharing and illegal sharing. And I think a lot of people in this community tend to play it off as, this doesn't bother me, this is, who cares? And I think Jason Black has strong arguments about illegal sharing and the problems of illegal sharing. So you're listening to Jason Black on file sharing on High Alert.
Now that today the music business is quite unpredictable, it's changed a lot in the last 10 years. How would you describe it today?
You know, it's really weird. It's definitely, you know, you can sit here and talk about technology all day long. I mean, at the same time, for as many artists as there are that are kind of making a weird random breakthrough, you know, on the internet or on YouTube or something like that, it really isn't that much different than when, you know, just kind of, I guess, unsuspecting artists would break through on radio or on video. Because as much as people are like, oh, it's an even playing field now, it still is an even playing field, more so than it was before, but you still have to have the access and the knowledge to get, you know, say you're going to get huge from something on the internet. Not just any band that makes a good record is going to do that. Like, they're going to have someone that knows how to make that happen. So it's still, while the model is changing a little bit, I don't think that the method is really that much different. I think there's different tools. I mean, the biggest difference is people think music should be free now. Like, the general population thinks that music, and for that matter, television and movies, should be free.
Art should be free.
Right, and exactly. You know, and it's kind of easier to peg the entertainment industry because that resonates with more people than, you know, whatever high art does. But if you make something and you sell it and someone doesn't pay for it, that's stolen. I mean, you know, I'm not in any way trying to, I actually don't really have a stance on the downloading because it's sort of like, it's almost ridiculous to even care about it at this point. But until people flip that mindset, they're going to run into all the things that people are complaining about where bands break up, shows cost more money. Like, of course shows cost more money. People used to buy our records. Now they don't buy our records. They're going to cost more money. Of course, movies cost more money to go see because people are just stealing them on the internet, you know. Of course, same thing. People complain about free streaming services on the internet like Hulu, like, oh, God, there's commercials on this. This is so annoying. I'm like, I don't disagree that commercials are annoying, but that is how these television shows are paid for. So, you know, for whatever reason, there's a generation gap where people think they should just, if they can find it, they should take it. And I think that's what people need to be concerned about more than prosecuting people that take things. They should educate people that they're really doing everyone a disservice.
And it's this ethic that we've been talking about. And just,
yeah, why would, I think stealing is the lamest thing ever.
And especially, you know, art.
Unless it's to survive. Like, I had to steal a loaf of bread from the baker because I'm a bum. Okay, fine, whatever. But yeah, stealing something that someone made purely out of, like, creative expression and just going, I'm going to take that because I can, because I have an internet connection, it's pretty lame. I mean, you're doing it from the safety of your own home at this point too. You know, I would say that I have more respect for people to break into your car and steal your stereo than someone who steals a record.
Right.
Because at least they're physically doing something and putting themselves in some form of jeopardy for doing it.
I think you say it perfectly in the sense that, you know, they do it from their own home, in the safety of their own home, so they don't even see it as stealing. They see it as, this is rightly mine.
Yeah, it's like, just because you can find it on the computer doesn't mean that it's yours. You know, and I'll never sit here and say that I've never downloaded anything either because...
Of course.
I have. Everyone has. You know what I mean? Everyone at least tried it to see if the police showed up at their door afterwards or whatever, you know. But it's now come to the point where it literally is such a struggle for bands, you know, and people are now going, well, records should only cost this much money to make. It should only cost this much money to sell. And the general quality of the sound quality of records now is terrifying because people listen to it on their speakers, on their laptop, and steal it and won't pay for it. So they're just really, I mean, they're diluting the whole thing on a really giant level that, you know, they just don't think about it. And like I said, you can't really fault anyone for it. It's too easy to do. But at the same time, I feel like there is a, I mean, I don't want to, this sounds really curmudgeon-y, but like, parents need to teach people not to steal. I mean, like, and this, you know, that is number one. Like, I mean, any of my friends are like, oh, I just downloaded this record. I'm like, dude, it was $10. You're going to go buy two beers at the bar tonight. Why don't you buy someone's record? Like, Budweiser does not need your money anymore. You know, it's, That's sort of my thought process, and it comes from a lot of the people in the scene that jump up and down about prices for this and that. We'll go spend $40 on beer at a show
and
then complain when your t-shirt's $15. Like, well, all you did right now is buy yourself a hangover and maybe some bad decisions. Like, that's a shirt that you can wear as long as you'd like, or a record you could listen to until it wears out.
That's right.
So it's a little, I mean, it's all about perception, you know, and it, like I said, you can't fault anybody for it, but it's definitely an unending circle of issues at that point.
And like you say, you know, it as a community, and if we see punk rock or this kind of independent scene as a community, this community can only exist if we support it.
Like I said, people don't have trouble going and paying for, like, booze or coffee or cigarettes or gas or whatever, which is like, I mean, Jesus Christ, if you want to talk about somebody that's running a bad, terrifyingly unfair business model, I think oil companies would be at the top of my list. But they have to get in their car to go places, so they buy the gas. And it's like, okay, so you're okay with giving these people that literally don't care about you at all far more money than they deserve for this product that's actually ruining the world. Yeah, you're going to steal from someone who is maybe having trouble paying rent and made a record that you can listen to forever. It just doesn't make any sense.
And even on a quality level, I think it was Neil Young who said, you know, the digital age in some ways has ruined the quality of music because people are stealing music. The quality of the MP3 is so low that it sounds like crap.
Yeah, it truly, truly does.
So people aren't even listening to how the records were intended to be heard in the first place.
No, not at all. And that's what I'm saying. It's like, not only are you stealing it, you have no idea what version of it you're stealing. And the worst thing that happens to a lot of bands is their record will leak, people will steal it and spread it, and it's not mastered, it's not mixed, it's being spread around with terrible MP3 quality, it's in the wrong track order. So you have now judged a record on all of the wrong principles and merits and completely out of context. Like going to see a movie before the special effects are done and saying it's no good. You know, it's just kind of like, wow.
When we talk about this stuff and you as a musician putting out this new record, you know, it can get frustrating. How do you, you know, put this to the side and get back to exactly what you're doing? You know what I mean?
Well, you just kind of hope that people are going to come around. I mean, for everyone that steals the record, there's hope for someone that buys it. I mean, and honestly, there's a lot of other things I need to take care of during my day than trying to figure out how to combat online piracy with my record. So it's sort of like, I'm going to leave that up to the label to try to make sure it doesn't happen. I mean, as for us, we, just as people in the band, haven't given our record to any of our friends at all. Not because we don't trust them. It's just we don't want to be the one that is responsible for someone that we're friends with being like, oh, it'll be fine if I give it to you. Because maybe it's not. And then you end up with the record out there. And, you know, that ruins a lot of hard work that people at the record label and people at management and people at publicity and all these other people have been putting hours and hours into presenting this thing that we've worked on the way that we want it presented. And one person can totally ruin that whole thing for you.
And what was 15, 20 years ago was, you know, we would trade tapes. And it would only stay within the circle of friends.
Yeah, exactly. Like, if people were still just burning CDs for each other, that's great, because that's actually, like, a boots-on-the-ground way of spreading the word.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like with the internet, it's just there's too much for people to choose from. They don't pay attention to anything. You know, everyone's attention span is so short now that it's, you know, it really isn't the same. Like you were saying, that was the community thing. Like, dude, have you heard this band? They're awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Not like, I know I like this band, therefore I'm going to steal their record and listen to it.
And it took time. It took time to get that record. You had to send your money to some record label, and you had to wait in time to get the package in the mail, and you usually got, you know, an extra sticker. You know, when you're reading Maximum Rock and Roll back in the day, you were excited about looking at all the ads to see what new records were coming out.
You'd pour through the reviews and see, like, did they compare anybody to any bands I like? Okay, cool, I should buy that.
Yeah.
And, you know, on the flip side of that, it's nice that the scene has kind of grown into this giant thing that it has now with some bands that are hugely successful. You know, because that was really hard back then, and it was kind of, you know, few and far between that ever made it out of being around for a couple of years. But at the same time, that, like, kind of intimacy of it is just completely lost now. Mm. You know, and I think, I mean, that's probably the one thing I miss about it the most, where it's like, there's not a whole lot of people, like, there aren't people trading tapes and ordering records by the mail as much as there used to be. Mm-hmm. Because you can just kind of go online and find whatever you want. Mm. I think that instant gratification takes a lot of the, I don't, like, charm out of it, I guess.
Yeah, well, there is something about, you know, holding on to a desire and then fulfilling it, kind of the old idea of, we're really thirsty, but let's run around the block three more times, we'll be even more thirsty, and that glass of water will be really good.
Exactly. I mean, it's cool waiting to hear a record. I mean, I don't want to, you know, I always want to hear everyone's new record, but I never want to hear a record in the wrong context.
Right. Right.
Because you can't erase the first impression of it.
Right.
Well, I got my heart up in a beautiful mess. I should have known better when I took the risk. I had to wreck myself and a gamble I broke. Yeah, shaking something mental I lost for the words I once told. Showing respect. I found a pedestal and burning down to kill my idols and to bury the thoughts underground. No longer death to the soul. I'm hardly feeling human.
That was the song Drag My Body from Hot Water Music, Hot Water Music's new record, Exister. And Hot Water Music will be in Montreal in September with Rise Against and Gaslight Anthem. I really like this interview with Jason Black because I like his forthfulness about talking about illegal piracy and sharing music from the artist's perspective.
From an artist's perspective.
From an artist's perspective, obviously.
And there's aspects to it that I feel I want to challenge. When Jason Black is talking about stealing from artists who are producing music in their home for the purpose of artistic creation, I don't think that that's the case. I think that these are artists who are purposely creating music in order to take part in what Jason Black later defines as a flawed business model when he's critiquing the oil industry. Well, that's why these artists are experiencing frustration. I think and it's the exact same frustration we're hearing from record companies and from movie companies and from publishing houses. This is a flawed, outdated model that doesn't work anymore in relation to these emerging technologies.
It's pretty hard not to see the change in model here as inevitable. It's copyright's been around for maybe a couple hundred years, and before copyright, artists, musicians, writers managed to make a living. We're at a point now where computers are ubiquitous. They are machines designed to copy information from one place to another, and no matter what mechanisms different people in different industries try and put in place to prevent people from copying things from one place to another, they're consistently circumvented. Doesn't seem to me to be any question that file sharing is something that's here to stay. That's something that is not going to go away, no matter what legislation people try to ram through in order to combat it.
The example of the artist Beck I find incredibly interesting. Beck's new album is being released as sheet music. It isn't being released as a performance. There's no accompanying audio track to the sheet music. Is being released as a booklet of songs that have previously not been released by Beck, and so fans who want to experience the songs will have to play them. And so what I imagine will happen is that there's going to be this amazing culture that's going to build around it on online channels of people learning the songs, playing them, developing their own interpretations of Beck's songs. But it's just going to sidestep the whole issue entirely.
And I think that's a great example of thinking outside of the box in terms of music. But within the box, I think bands like Hot Water Music have adapted fairly well because they're doing quite well. And they're doing quite well in the sense that they're touring a lot. And their guarantees have changed accordingly, so that they can make a decent living on an annual basis. So I don't think, Hot Water Music are starving. I think they're doing quite well. And but again, from a listener's perspective, who do you want to support? And I think the argument that he makes is, I think, quite clear. You have no problem supporting Marlboro. You have no problem supporting Budweiser. But why then do you become all hot and bothered because somebody's telling you, once you buy this record, that means a whole lot to you, that might have changed your life. This band, for a lot of bands, might have changed your whole life. You know, some of these bands mean a lot. So why not support them by going to a show, buying a record, or buying a t-shirt?
So I'm really excited about the next interview we're doing with Kathleen Winter for a lot of these reasons. Kathleen is a Montreal-based author. Her last novel, Annabelle, was nominated for the Governor General's Award. And she's someone who experienced a significant change of heart around file sharing and seeing her novel being made available in all sorts of online channels.
Could you tell us who you are and a bit about yourself?
I'm Kathleen Winter, and I was born in the north of England and came to Newfoundland when I was a kid and lived there for most of my life. And I've been in Montreal for 4 years, and I've written a novel called Annabelle that's been translated all over the world after a lifetime of basically freelance hovels and oblivion. So I've gone from going to food banks and barely making a living, kind of by choice, so I could write, to having this amazing thing happen with a book that sold all over the world.
I'm going to ask you about the book and about your process of making money from your art, but I want you to tell me about J.K. Rowling and her new book.
Well, I just read today that her publisher has prohibited, or I guess she and her agent and her publisher, they prohibited the sale of the book to territories or countries around the world. They don't want it to be translated into the language of any country or territory where it's easier to pirate. It's easier to make knockoff copies. And what I didn't know is, for many years, they never allowed Harry Potter to be published electronically for the same reason. So I just think it's incredibly interesting that she and her publishers would feel this way and would take those steps.
Mm-hmm. What's your relationship with your publisher around this stuff?
I've talked to Anansi a bit about it because I got on my high horse and sent them a frantic email when I discovered that my book was being pirated. Like, my first reaction was I felt flattered. Oh, I'm one of the real writers whose work is, you know, you can get it for free on the internet. But my immediate reaction was to email them and say, you know, this must be stopped, and did you know? And they tried to. They did manage to shut down a couple of sites, but they gently let me know that it was a bit of an exercise in futility. And then I started to find out more about it and think more about it and talk with more people about it, and I'm finding it a really interesting dialogue. You know, should you or shouldn't you be upset when that happens as a writer?
Mm-hmm. And you, there was one conversation in particular that you were telling me about that really struck a chord for you.
Well, when I first got all outraged on Facebook and on my blog and said, you know, don't you know that I used to go to food banks? Don't you know that this is, you know, decades of my life? Next time you go get my book for free, just think, I'm an artist. Why would anybody steal from an artist? And so I got various messages back. Some people, mostly writers, were all gung-ho and agreed with me completely. But a lot of people thought that I was being ridiculous and actually got angry with me for having those opinions. So immediately, I'm always interested in polarized discussions, especially when they affect me. But that there seemed to be just such a polarized conflict about it. And I personally did feel threatened. I felt like this lovely income that I'm suddenly getting after all this lifetime of not having any money is threatened. So I got this email from a filmmaker, a young filmmaker in London called Richard Phoenix. And he agreed with the people who told me not to worry, but he did it in such a loving way and such a kind and informative way with such new ways of thinking about it that I had to kind of step back and say, wait a minute, what's going on here? Which is what I always do when I'm faced with a kind of, you know, with that kind of polarized discussion of black and white and right and wrong. So,
what was it that he said?
Well, first of all, he said, hush, little mite. You know, he didn't say either, yes, Kathleen, way to go, or you idiot. He said, hush, little mite. And then he said, it'll be okay. And the reason why it'll be okay is because there's a whole new paradigm, a whole new way of sharing ideas and culture and reading and books, and you have to find out about that. And I still didn't really know what he was talking about, so we had a bit of a dialogue about it. And he seemed to think that just because people could get Annabelle for free, they could get my novel for free, in no way meant that other people wouldn't pay for it. That was one thing. And he cited a few statistics of, you know, books that had actually, I think Neil Gaiman was one writer, for example, who himself had said, you know, his books had been file shared to no end, but it seemed that his income increased exponentially, almost as a result of it. So there was that argument. But there was also something in it that was sort of beyond economics that really interested me. And Richard Phoenix told me that my work was like pollen, and it would spread and settle by the action of the wind, and that I shouldn't worry if some of it settled in places where I didn't get any immediate compensation, because other bits of the pollen would settle in places where I would. And I thought that was very interesting. Again, not because it was kind of... It didn't give me any solid comfort, but I knew there was something in that that I wanted to look at. And it kind of tied in with a life-changing experience that I recently had in the Arctic, which has colored everything I'm looking at and has colored everything that I'm writing and doing and thinking and being. And because of that, I took back everything I said online about, you know, the evil theft that was going on of my book, and I decided to look at it another way. But you asked me about the publisher. When I told her these things, she said she had a hard time thinking along those lines. As a publisher, she had a really hard time.
Thinking along which lines?
Along the lines of, it's okay for people to get the book for free when we, the publisher, are spending money on editors and overhead on warehouses and all of our expenses. It's hard for her to wrap her mind around the idea that there could be anything good about the book being available for free. When I went to the Arctic, I had a realization that happened that had to do with air. And I realized in the far north, in the company of the land, the tundra and the ice and the polar bear who I met and the sky, that there was a whole lot more to air than what I had been thinking. And a whole lot more to rocks and land and the planet than I had been, to the material world. And this might sound really strange, but I realized beyond any doubt that it was conscious, that the air had consciousness, that I was part of the mind of the world. I don't know if I can explain that any better, but the way it relates to everything that we're talking about is that when I came back, I could no longer see things in terms of separate, conflicting entities. I was much more aware of how we are connected to other, seemingly other things, rather than how we're separate from them. And that got me really, you can see these books that I'm looking at now, it kind of was a key to a whole way of looking at the world that I had not really looked at before. And it had to do with exactly that thing of the publishing world being big fish eating little fish eating even smaller fish, which is the same model that exists in, you know, the whole monetary and economic system worldwide, wherever things happen the way they happen in North America. So I'm really interested in what I'm writing now. I'm really interested in how it is born of ideas that came to me freely on the air, like pollen. I'm really interested in making a living, continuing to make a living, but I'm less caught up in that old model of me writing for a publisher who is going to pay me, and that being this straightforward, you know, train, this chain of logical events. I don't see it that way anymore. I see it in a much more mysterious and organic way. I still have a lot of questions about how that will work practically, but it's way more exciting. Because if you look at it in terms of, oh, boo-hoo, I'm not getting that 10% royalty on my book, what you're saying really is, oh, boo-hoo, the publisher is no longer getting, you know, $27, and I'm no longer getting three out of the hardcover $30 book. That's a pretty top-heavy model of payment anyway. I mean, if we're going to complain about people getting things for free, maybe we should also be asking, isn't that a bit old and fossilized, that whole model of the primary producer, like the fisherman or the artist, or, you know, you get, you know, your little fish, you get your penny for your little fish, and somebody else is making all the money.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like you're making a lot anyway. I really have rambled on here.
But I think you're developing a really nice cohesive thread between a process of self-awakening to social responsibility, the purpose of art, and ideas of I don't know, maybe interconnections between people. And one of the things that I really like about how you present yourself publicly is your blog. And you've got this blog, and on it you've made available this really broad spectrum of creations that you've come up with. You've got paintings, you've got poems, you have reflections on the world, and you've put it out freely. And has that been a vehicle for you to exchange with folks? How has the format that you've decided to use with the blog been informed by some of these reflections that you're having?
Well, I've always made things other than text. And so you're right, I like putting my paintings and poems and visual things there as well. And I guess I would like to think that people enjoy it, but I don't really know what people think of it very much, or how, you know, I don't have a sense, the same sense that I would have if I did a public reading of how people feel about it, and I don't get as much feedback as I do from my writing, because I guess I'm more engaged publicly as a writer. My blog almost feels private to me in a way, even though I'm very aware that it's not, but I do like putting very personal things in it. And I do like experimenting with showing new kinds of, with showing my visual work, which it gives me more confidence about it. I would like to write a book that has a visual component, and making the blog helps me to practice, and it helps me to feel good about the paintings.
I wanted to ask you about the radical possibilities in short stories.
The thing that I'm writing now really encompasses some of those things we've been talking about. It's all about getting to a place where the planet is calling out a gargantuan SOS right now, and it's just unbelievable that so many people in places of power are completely deaf to it, or they've somehow deluded themselves into thinking we have more time. So I'm writing about that, but I'm writing about it in a veiled and slanted and a kind of backwards and inside out way, using maybe techniques of fiction within a nonfiction context. But for me, I can't fool around making up only fictional stories right now when we're in such an important time in the life of the planet. I think that I had the blessing of being woken up by that Arctic trip. I don't know why I woke up then in the way that I did. I was kind of half awake before it, but it just shook me and completely galvanized me. And I feel a responsibility to put that in my writing. I really feel that the earth and the animals in the north spoke to me and said, hey, you're a writer. Can you go back down there and tell people what we're saying? And I feel like I'm the least qualified person to do that, really and truly the least qualified person in terms of what do I know about what's really going on in the North. But again, it's a bit like with Annabelle. Even though in some ways I don't feel I have the right to do it, I have no other thing that I could possibly be contented doing right now. I mean, this is just so important. When I was up there, the military was crawling around the beaches in their camouflage outfits, you know, staking territory for Stephen Harper's ownership of the North. And the Coast Guard ship that rescued us when we were grounded on an uncharted rock was full of scientists, full of geologists who were mapping the floor of the ocean in the far north for British Petroleum. And everywhere you looked, there were bones and fossils and bits of shipwrecks right from the time of Franklin and all of the ships that went looking for him and have not found him yet. So there's layers of history, and there's this amazing, visible, colonial layering of stuff that's just lying on the ground, combined with the, you know, perpetuation of that whole way of raping land and owning it and commodifying it that we're still doing. So to me, there's nothing that I could possibly write in the world of fiction that even approaches the importance of that.
How would you like to see this body of work that you're writing right now? How would you like to see it shared? Are you planning on putting it out on your blog? Are you planning on getting it published? How would you feel if you saw it being freely disseminated?
I feel that the importance of the message, which is a message from the planet that I happen to overhear, probably means that it needs to be freely disseminated.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to send my manuscript to my agent, and I hope she's going to sell it to somebody, and I hope I'll somehow get enough money to pay my bills. But I'm not looking for an obscene amount of money more than what I need to live.
Mm-hmm.
I like being able to travel, but when I write, people invite me to go to really cool places, so I don't really need to save up money for airfare anymore. I buy giant bags of organic azuki beans for hardly any money, and it lasts pretty much all year, so like I don't need a lot of money. I'm very, very good at living on a shoestring after all the years when I didn't have money. So it's what I'm really interested in is not hoarding, but using any kind of money or whatever I get on my plate given to me, using it, learning how to use it collectively in a way of service.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really interested in that. I'm a person who's, I have a husband and I have daughters who are almost grown up, and I'm in a place now where I can see within a couple of years I won't need to live in a sort of a place where I'm looking after a child who's going to school and I need to have everything all properly done. So I'm looking after my health and really keeping my eyes open about ways of living and ways of being that could be... There's a fight that has to be fought. And the other thing that, before I went to the Arctic, I didn't realize that so many people are already fighting it. I was more maybe overwhelmed by the evils of, right-wing governments and Monsanto and all of it. I was really overwhelmed by the evil and the greed and the destruction. But now I'm learning about the incredible amount of organic and grassroots work that has been going on. I was blind to it because I didn't know it was there.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm really interested in joining that and being active in that. So I'm kind of in a learning period right now where I'm reading everything I can and kind of talking to people, and I feel a bit like a kind of innocent, stupid baby that was going around like a slug for most of my life that suddenly got woken up by the polar bears, and it's really odd. It's really strange. It's like I just got a bolt of lightning.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a lot of resources, and I have a lot of blessings, and I have a lot of... I've been put in this place of where people are actually wondering what I'm going to write next, and they would like to see it, and they would like to pay me for it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in a perfect position, really, even though I don't feel qualified, I'm in a perfect position to tell the story that the planet told to me in the North.
Mm-hmm.
I just hope I don't fuck it up. I just hope I put myself in the right place, which is really, it's interesting because it's in the same place as any human would be, but I don't want to be disassociated, but I don't want it to be about me in any sense. This is not about me. It's about all of us collectively.
What I really appreciate about this interview with Kathleen Winter is the connection that she makes between the predominant business model that we see in the arts industry and the predominant business model that we see at the direct core of what ails us, socially speaking.
Well, one of the things I think that to me was interesting about this interview was more, you know, the visceral reaction that she had seeing people download her book freely, and then kind of looking back and maybe seeing, well, maybe this is not all bad. Maybe somewhere, you know, the sharing of these ideas freely would actually promote my work, and in another way, other people will buy my book that might not have never heard of the book if it wasn't shared so freely.
And to foster the sense of community that I feel was part of your interest in doing this show. There's in speaking with Kathleen before we agreed to do the interview, I was really drawn to her curiosity and developing community around her practice as an artist and wanting to explore different ways of looking at that. And it kept making me think about the example of the Tarn Adams, who's a video game creator who came up with the game Dwarf Fortress. Dwarf Fortress is a video game that's available for free download on the internet. And it's incredibly popular. It's a game that's hugely complex, that has no visual aspect whatsoever. It's played entirely using an ASCII visual interface. And Tarn Adams has made his game freely available, but he's allowing people to donate to the game. And him and his brother, over the weekend, every week, they get together, and anyone who's donated to receive the game will receive a hand-drawn representation of a scene that could presumably take place in the game. And so they get together, they bust out markers and Crayolas, and they come up with these really, really simple drawings and mail them out to folks all over the world. And this is just such an incredibly creative response to wanting to create community around a product.
And you know what? It makes me think of what Louis C.K. is doing in order to promote his work through the internet and combating in the same way file sharing. Louis C.K. is selling most of his stand-up comedy routines for $5 on his website. And for example, Live at the Beacon Theater sold 110,000 copies with $200,000 profit. His new tour that the tickets can only be bought through his own website, therefore cutting out the middleman, Ticketmaster, also putting a lot of restrictions into those tickets cannot be resold, therefore cutting out scalpers. Well, it seems like it's profitable because in 45 hours after the tour began selling its tickets, he's made $4.5 million from his U.S. tour. So these new models are very interesting in ways of combating online piracy, but also thinking outside the box on how the artist can actually also make a living.
I think in the example of Louis C.K., yes, you know, he is actively trying to combat file sharing by boxing content into his site. But I think a lot of the new models we're discussing aren't combating file sharing. They're embracing it. And Dan Bohl, our next interviewee, is a fine example of that. He's somebody who has freely distributed his music through all sorts of online means and used that to build a giant fan base, to build this popularity and ultimately to create a livelihood.
Dear Peter Mandelson, I've been following your recent policy proposals, so now they've gone through, I thought I'd contribute some vocals. The focal point of my criticism's the ridiculous decision to bring in a system where you flick a switch and disconnect the internet when it's suspected that intellectual infringement has been detected, even if the relatives they live with definitely didn't. I think it's in your best interest to bin this, yes? Cause isn't it a respected institution that we're considered innocent unless different is proven? Excuse me, how can you excuse exclusion when you've not pursued a definite conclusion? You're picking on the little man, the Lilliputian. Now there's a pain in my gulliver and it's confusing. You're swift to treat your citizens with such little human humor, but it's no wonder that we're disillusioned. This resolution's gonna end in revolution, just like any other governance that doesn't accept evolution. To be perfectly honest, my lord, there'd be less intrusion if you curtly abolished the law and left us to it. And why do games require safety ratings, but any age can see adult aim plays and paintings? It's state censorship, the same as Beijing, but even China thinks a pirate isn't worth the time of day for chasing. I think Chairman Mao would say the same thing. Since you became secretary, it's like the state you're plaything. You made a massive sacrifice, invaded loads of privacy, but if I wanted to download, there'd be no hope of finding me. I could take my mobile phone to the local library and utilize the free wireless to find the file I need. Then what you gonna try to disconnect their ISP? You might as well just burn the books on rights to speech. Dear Mandy, stay away from my family. Yours considerably angrily, Dan Bull. Dear Mandy, stay away from my family. Yours considerably angrily, Dan Bull. Ooh, profit from the digital economy bill. Not the public, but the profiteers probably will. Ooh, profit from the digital economy bill. Not the public, but the puppeteers probably will. I've talked about how intellectual property kills, and you're still just concerned with who's copping the bill. It's quite obvious you've been lobbied until the copy holders got control, and you're probably the shill. It's not your problem when you're positioned on top of the hill in your property that probably cost a couple of mil. But wake up and smell the coffee, the milk is going off, and you're not bothered cause your coffers are filled. Lord, it's time you took an honesty pill and acknowledge the majority aren't horribly thrilled. So what if I watched a torrented comedy film? I don't need to, now my country's just become a Brazil. You know the truth, Orwell spoke his views, your house broke the news and all hell's broken loose. The utopia we hope for is overdue, so could you help out a little bit and don't be stupid? The onus is on you to show us you aren't using your throne in a way the voters don't approve. I know you're very close to David Geffen, so maybe his interests are giving you a haze perception. Hey, do you reckon you'd win today's election, considering you're chasing this amidst a great recession? Deception's the politician's favourite weapon, but we're already jaded from one too many painful lessons. Dear Mandy, stay away from my family. Yours considerably angrily, Dan Bull. Dear Mandy, stay away from my family. Yours considerably angrily, Dan Bull. I love you, Mandy.
All right. We're talking to UK musician, rapper, and digital rights activist Dan Bull. Dan, you've stated publicly that you don't believe in intellectual property, you rarely do shows, and you give your music away free of charge. How does all of that align with your desire to earn a living as a musician?
Well, I certainly do have a strong desire to earn a living as a musician. The difference is, I don't feel that I'm entitled to that living through intellectual property, because I think intellectual property is indistinguishable from an idea, and I don't see how an idea can belong to somebody when if you tell that idea to someone else, they've instantly have that idea in their head. There's no way to reclaim it and say, hey, it's yours, you can't use it. I really want to make a living as a musician. I don't feel I'm entitled to it, so that's why I'm trying to find creative new ways of monetizing what I do without treading on people's feet, on people's toes, and saying, look, this file that you've got on your computer is my property. I want you to delete it or pay for it.
We've interviewed a number of musicians already for this episode and discussed file sharing as a topic. There's been a wide range of responses, from file sharing is taking food off my kitchen table to file sharing helps to promote my band, but it doesn't pay the bills. Does file sharing pay your bills?
File sharing in itself doesn't pay the bills. However, I've through sharing my music as torrents and allowing people to download it as freely as possible, I've found a lot of new fans that I wouldn't have had otherwise. If you look at when I really started to embrace using file sharing as a promotional strategy, you'll see that's the same point when my music really sort of jumped up in popularity. And I found a lot of the people that had first of all downloaded the thing for free had then gone on to become a longer term fan who will buy the CD off me and stuff like that. And just to continue on from that, I know that not everybody who downloads will think there's any point in then going on to buy the CD and stuff because they've already got that file. So one of the things I'm doing is trying to bring back scarcity into the digital age where files are so freely replicable that they don't really have any worth unless there's laws protecting them from being copied. So I'm trying to bring back in scarcity by offering things like when people buy my CD, I'll personally write a little note for them or a little rhyme on any subject of their choice. So that gives value back to something where the value's been stripped away by the digital age.
You've undertaken a campaign recently with support from the Pirate Bay. You've been asking fans to purchase your freely available song, Sharing is Caring, in an effort to make it appear on UK and international singles charts. How are things going so far?
I don't get to see any of the figures until they're made public, which is unfortunate. So I can't tell you sales-wise how well things are doing, but the feedback to it's been brilliant. Even if it turns out to be a total failure in terms of chart positioning, I've made lots of new fans, spoken to lots of new people, and I've had a lot of fun, which is one of the main reasons why I like to do the music. So regardless of the outcome, I think it'll be a positive learning experience for me.
If you succeed, do you expect that the music industry will get the message you are trying to send them?
I'm not sure whether the music industry will change at all because of that. I think what it will do is show that there are more than one way of doing things. You don't have to, if you want to get to the upper tier of the music business, you don't have to be signed to a major label. You don't have to promote your music in a certain way, that there are alternatives and that you can succeed by doing things in the way that you feel comfortable.
Something else we heard a lot of in talking to various musicians was the notion that, sure, you can survive as a musician with a model based on file sharing, but you need to be a skilled marketer and possibly even a skilled web developer to pull it off. Would you say that's true?
I think that's certainly true. If you spend all your time only making music and not doing anything else, then it might be the best music in the world. But if there's not either you or someone else getting it out there and sending it to the right places and making sure it's heard, then you may as well not have written the song. I mean, it's only going to be as much a success as the amount of work that's put into getting it heard.
Do you have advice for musicians that perhaps want to market themselves in a manner similar to you but lack those technical and marketing skills?
Yeah, I'd say the internet is a really great opportunity for finding other people who do have those skills, and maybe there's someone out there who's really interested in promoting music but doesn't know someone whose music they can promote. The internet is a great place for networking with people who are really interested in helping each other out, collaborating and stuff. I mean, I can't think of an example of a specific site where you might go and find that, but there's definitely hundreds and thousands of people out there with all sorts of different skills, graphic designers, promoters, people who will even collaborate with you musically. It's all out there. You just need to go and find it.
You have a close relationship to your fans. They appear in your music videos. They purchase music off you directly. How does your experience differ from the traditional rock star of 20 years ago?
I think the traditional rock star of 20 years ago was a lot more mysterious and sort of had this untouchable myth around them where they didn't really exist in the real world and they were on this sort of higher plane. And I think that's something that just seems like nonsense to me. I mean, it's quite fun to read these rock biographies about Led Zeppelin and stuff and how they were almost considered as gods, but in reality, for most musicians, that's just, it's just not the case. I don't think I'm ever going to reach a level like that. So rather than aspiring to it, I'm going in completely the opposite direction and just jumping in and talking to as many fans as possible and engaging them and getting them involved, because I'm having a lot more fun that way than having any sort of pretensions that I'm above anyone else or I'm ever going to be.
As a result of your work, you've had an opportunity to communicate with a number of online groups that have been portrayed negatively by mainstream media, especially here in North America. What would you say is off in the way groups like Anonymous and the Pirate Bay are portrayed by news organizations across the world?
The thing about... I'll start with Anonymous. The thing about Anonymous is they aren't really an organized group as such. It's just a banner that a lot of different people undergo, do different projects underneath. So it's not really a force for good or bad. It's just a very... a powerful force, I guess, that could swing either way. When you see Anonymous helping sites like WikiLeaks and stuff in exposing atrocities and stuff that have been committed overseas in Iraq and stuff like that, I think it's good. But other times when they've hacked certain websites or brought people down, or when people have been targeted for bullying and stuff through 4chan, it's bad. But I think the problem the media has with them is they want one quick label that they can put on something and say this group is good or this group is bad, and it's not quite that simple. With the Pirate Bay, I guess it comes down to your view on file sharing itself. Personally, I think file sharing is great, and I don't think it is as much of a threat as the traditional media make it out to be. I may be wrong. If it is a threat, then obviously the Pirate Bay is probably one of the biggest and worst factors in that problem.
Thanks again, Dan. Where should people go to find out more information about the Sharing is Caring campaign?
I'm promoting the Sharing is Caring campaign on my website, which is itsdanbull.com. That's itsdanbull.com. And you can find out about the single. There's a link at the top that says single or Sharing is Caring. I can't remember, but everything's on there.
Thanks. We've been talking with British rapper and activist Dan Bull. For more information, please visit itsdanbull.com. So, we've got Dan Bull, who I think clearly represents somebody who's very much moving forward with the sort of new model, the new way of things, this notion that file sharing is a benefit and not a curse. We've got Jason Black, who comes from an age where file sharing didn't really have an impact and has seen it have a dramatic effect on I suspect his income to some degree, certainly the way that he makes money. And we've got Kathleen, who has gone through this transition of sort of being terrified of file sharing and moving to embracing it. I think the one thing that is inevitable here is that the way that artists, musicians, writers make their money moving forward is going to change.
Yeah, and what's, I think, the biggest impact is going to be on the middleman, the record labels, the distribution, the record store, the bookstores, all the people who are involved in producing, packaging this artwork will suffer. But the opening, I think, might be that the artist might be able to get more control over how and in what way they want to present their art.
And I feel like I want to push back against the notion of suffering. When you're talking about the folks who are going to suffer as a result of it, there's an incredibly negative connotation to that I think is what's evoking this really strong pushback that we're seeing. And there's nothing wrong with things changing, and there's an incredible amount of potential that we can see coming out of these shifts, and I think we need to embrace that and to look at the extrapolating opportunities for learning that's going to come out of this evolving technology.
Yeah, I do agree with you, but also, I mean, from, for example, Fat Records, who had 22 employees and went down to 3 in the space of 2 years, there are people who actually lose their jobs, and people who actually enjoyed their jobs, loved their jobs, end up not having any work. A friend of mine who runs a record company who's fairly successful pretty much had to close shop because of the impact of stealing music. So I think, you know, on a very realistic level, there are people who have to change and suffer from it because the music business and the way that people get music has changed.
This isn't a new process. So, I mean, there are no more telegraph operators. It just ceased to exist as an occupation at some point, and that's sort of the continuous cycle of human development, I suppose.
Yeah, you're right. So I think, for me at least, it's this show was a way to reflect as a consumer of music, as a lover of music or a lover of art, where do I want to spend my money? Where do I want to support? And knowing that when I do buy that record for $10, I am actually supporting a community, an artist. And to me, reflecting on that it's extremely important to me.
And if you're not buying that physical record or buying that downloadable record, maybe you should be looking at opportunities that artists are presenting to support them. People like the Tarn Adams of the world, the Dan Bowles of the world, who may not necessarily be selling you songs, but are providing you with a way to support them nonetheless.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Thank you.
I think we're going to close now with Kathleen Winter delighting us with the concertina.
This is called the Varsovienne, and it's an old Polish waltz.
To the High Alert Podcast. Find us online at highalert.net and on Twitter at High Alert Show. Send us feedback via email at info@highalert.net. For more information on Jason Black, visit hotwatermusic.com. For more information on Kathleen Winter, visit kathleenwinter.livejournal.com. For more information on Dan Bowl, visit itsdanbowl.com. The High Alert Podcast is recorded at Marsonic Studios in Montreal, Quebec. For more information on Marsonic, visit marsonic.com. We'll see you next time on High Alert.